So it gives me great pleasure to welcome my fellow author, Sizwe Mpofu-Walsh, to the show. Sizwe, welcome.
So Jane, so much. Thanks so much. Glad to be with a fellow mixed race mafia member.
It is such a treat to finally get you on, and I've been meaning to have you on for months and months and months, and then my colleagues jumped in front of me in a rather unchivalrous fashion. But here you are on late nights, and it's such a pleasure, and it was so great meeting you briefly at Open Book the other day. And so let me just first say congratulations on this book that I'm holding in my grubby little hand, Democracy and Delusion, 10 Myths in South African Politics. Well done to you, my brother. Well done.
Thank you so very much. Coming from someone who keeps pipping me to the number one post in the selling charts, every time I look at a bookshop, it just means that little bit more.
Okay, listen, it's going to happen. You are ahead of me in the game. It's happening. And also, you know what I love about this book is that I'm loving being able to read a book where I can pick up and go, today I'm going to read myth number five. And I read myth number five, and I don't necessarily have had to have read myth number two and three, which I have. But it's just nice. This is a new book. This book is so needed. I'm so glad that you have written it. Tell me why you did write it.
Well, I felt as though we were having the same conversation over and over again. In South Africa, I felt that the political conversation was growing stale, and a large reason for that, I thought, was that even though we pretended to disagree, we all actually agreed on the fundamental assumptions, you know, that South Africa is making progress, even if slow, that, you know, certain redistributive measures would be nice, but they're really impossible in practice. Mm. And so I wanted to try and shake us out of our complacency and say that our long-held assumptions are actually what's holding us back, and we should reassess them.
You obviously have a political history. Your family certainly has political history. How much do you think that your parents have influenced where you stand, not politically in terms of your political persuasions, but in terms of your wanting to speak out about the importance of speaking out and getting involved in politics and getting involved in South Africa, the country?
Sure. I think they've been really important. Obviously, certainly not in the sense that they were sitting behind me while I was writing and telling me what to say, which I think a lot of people have assumed. But through their example, through the fact that they were political activists, and in fact, political activism is how they met, and I dare say how I was born.
Yeah.
And so politics has always been not just another thing that happens, but is the thing, really, in our family.
Yeah.
And I suppose the other one thing I'd like to say about that is, while a lot of people know my father, Dali Mpofu, in case you didn't.
Yeah.
I might as well just get it out the way now.
Yeah.
I think it's actually quite interesting that people, and I think it's an example of patriarchy in the traditional sense, that people think that your ideas come through the men and, in fact, the father figure in your family.
Absolutely.
But if anything, my mother has been equal, if not a more important political influence in my life, and her political ideas have certainly shaped me throughout my life and also in this book.
Talk to us a little bit about growing up with your parents as your parents.
Sure.
What were conversations like over the dinner table?
Well, I mean, as you know, I think you have been the embodiment of this, at least in the literary space right now. Mixed race families are far from normal, often, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And so we didn't really have a dinner table to start with because my parents actually were never married.
Yeah.
And so I actually grew up only knowing them as friends, really. I mean, their relationship ended very early in my life. So for most of my conscious life, I've known them as friends. So I really have different political conversations. I have always had different conversations with them in different places. We actually are seldom together.
Yeah.
But both of their lives have always been deeply political, and from the earliest age, our conversations have always been really political, in the sense not just of party politics, but in, I think my parents deeply care about the future of the country.
Yeah.
They are deeply invested in, you know, destroying the vestiges of apartheid, and that's always rubbed off on me.
You are studying at the moment. Are you still studying for your doctorate?
Yes, I am. My supervisor might say something different, but I am.
Yeah,
I am technically
spuriously studying for his doctorate.
yeah, well, publishing books in the complete opposite field. But
so just,
yeah.
What I wanted to ask you was: does your book form part of your doctorate?
No, in fact, after
oh, you
all of
fool.
This, I was like, you know what? That would have been a really good idea.
Why must you make more work for yourself?
I mean,
every time I've picked this book up, I've thought that is the question that I need to ask Siswe. Is this, we reading your final, you know, your dissertation piece?
I know. I really, really should have done that. You know, it just gives the lie to the idea that writing books makes you clever, because clearly I should have really thought of that before. But no, my PhD is in a disconnected area. It's in international relations, but it's all about nuclear weapons and non-proliferation.
So can we expect a book on that?
Look, right now I feel like I still have a lot of work to do on the PhD, but I would ultimately like it to be converted into a book. It'll probably be an esoteric, theoretical international relations book.
Yeah.
So don't worry, no chance of me overtaking you on the sales chart.
Listen, I want to obviously. I've got the book in my hand and I'm loving it.
Sure.
As I said to you, you know, my colleagues, you've spoken to Eusebius, you've spoken to Kuket, so they've gone through the book.
Yeah.
For those who have yet to pick up the book, and really, there's not that many people left. There's not. I mean, it's doing great guns. Just give us. I mean, you talk about that, as I said, the 10 myths in South African politics is a subline. Talk through 10 myths. What I'm enjoying the most, elite schools benefit society. Myth number 9, that is one of my, and I've read it and reread it. And the funny thing is that a relation of mine, I don't know if you would have been taught by her, but she is the deputy head at St. John's where you went. I'm fascinated to see what she makes of the book and of that chapter in particular, that myth in particular. You and I both know who we're talking about. And, and myth number 2, again, around education, free education is unachievable. I'm just giving people a taster of what they can expect. I really want to talk to you about your writing process. People can find out about the book by going to buy it, please, people. again, Democracy and Delusion, 10 Myths in South African Politics, Siswe Mpofu-Walsh. Let's talk about your writing process. How disciplined were you?
Well, firstly, this is really refreshing because you do get to a point where, firstly, you write the book and then you talk about it so much that, in actual fact, you really want to talk about the process of making it as opposed to what you say. So I appreciate the opportunity to do that.
No, for sure.
I think that I managed to develop some serious discipline towards the end.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. But it was certainly a process to get there. The book took 3 years to come to fruition. And really the first 2 years were kind of finding my feet. You know, you don't know whether the book is a real thing, and so you do other things,
so
and it kind of, it comes together.
You don't know if it's a real thing,
Absolutely, and you think, you know, and you tell people, I kind of think I'm writing a book, and they say, what, are you crazy? Why on earth would you write a book while you're doing all these other things?
Yeah.
And so it really came together quite slowly, and also finding the tone that I wanted to write in.
Did you already have your author's voice? Did you already have that? Because I feel when I look back and sort of if I have to go and do book readings and things, and I read a bit from the book, and I think, That's I've had this author's voice or this voice since I was really small. It's changed, obviously. It's matured, but this is which makes me think this is why I was always destined to write, is that this is me. This is my authentic self. This is me putting on, and this is how I write, and this is my author's voice. Does that make sense?
Wow, that's really interesting to hear. I actually didn't find that. I found that it actually took me a really long time to find that voice.
Sure.
So, lucky you, basically.
But I think that's because you're an intellectual.
That's true. And
I'm not.
I suppose when the fact that you were telling your story, I think maybe might have made it easier to find the voice you wanted to tell it in. Whereas because I was doing an academic program at the time, it really took me a long time to break out of the academic register.
You know, and it's so interesting, and I hope you take this from whence it comes. I see that in the first, in the first couple of, you didn't write them, did you write them consecutively?
No. But I see what, it does turn out that actually the beginning tends to be a bit more sort of fact-based, whereas the end becomes a bit more personal.
I see a lot more of you. Well, I see a lot more of you coming through at the end than I do at the beginning. And at the beginning, it reads, and this is certainly not a bad thing. I'm singing the praises of this book till the cows come home. But it seemed very academic. In terms of your writing, in terms of, you know, these are the things that I will be putting forward and I will be supporting them with this, which is, you have to do because you're not, you know, as you say, you're not writing a memoir, you're not writing a work of fiction. But I really did find that your author voice or your writing voice or whoever it was became so much stronger kind of towards the end. And I felt more, I'm hearing literally from Sizwe's mind here about from you personally.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's something, as again, you know, that you don't realize about a book, and only when people start engaging with it do you actually fully appreciate what you've written. But it is certainly true that the later chapters, many of which were actually written later, I began to go more introspective.
Yeah.
I began to share more of myself and how I came to the myths and the issues.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I think subconsciously I kind of put those at the end because I was, I think maybe I felt a bit more vulnerable when I was doing that. But it turns out that it actually seems to resonate with people more in the final chapters where I actually share more of my personal experiences.
Yeah. Is writer's block something you believe in?
Yes and no. So yes, to the extent that I very seldom sat down and just went on a flurry and produced brilliant work, if ever.
Well, but yeah.
But so I think it is a myth that brilliant writers get these flashes of inspiration and then just write books. So I actually found the process quite excruciating.
To the extent that,
yeah, absolutely. And the breakthrough for me, really, was, and I, as I say, in those first 2 years, I would write and I would expect it to be perfect the first time.
Yeah.
And I would sit there with horror as I came back to read it and just realize how terrible it was when I, and then I started actually reading and educating myself on writing.
Yes.
Like, how do people write? And I realized it never comes out right the first time. And Teju Cole says something really interesting on this. He says, you think you're going to become a writer, but you really are an editor.
Oh, so true.
Yeah. And so then I started realizing this is just about sculpting. It's about putting the clay down, but then it's about going over it again and again and again until something beautiful emerges. And so, I would just do that and that's really when I started hitting my stride, which was just putting things down, living with it being terrible, and then working really hard to make it better and better with each draft.
As you got towards the end and you found your rhythm a bit more, did it become more enjoyable? Or I suppose the question that I should ask prior to that is, was it an enjoyable process in general, writing the book? Or has it been enjoyable, or is it enjoyable when you hold it in your hand?
You know, I think it's a strange kind of enjoyable. There's something strangely beautiful about chipping away at something for a long time and seeing it take shape after tremendous effort. And there is something wonderful about that, you know, that there's actually a beauty that you don't, you know, I think a lot of life, certainly today, seems to be about gratification as soon as possible.
Yeah.
But there are incredible gratifications that come after extended work, you know, which you just have to just wait until you get there.
Yeah.
So certainly it has been really enjoyable. And towards the end, when I saw it take shape and I actually saw this thing that I conceived of becoming a real thing in the world, and certainly when it comes out, I mean, I was just beside myself and I actually had the book in my hands.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, a dream come true.
A dream come true.
But yeah, the process was long and hard to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm joined on the line by Sizwe Mpofu-Walsh, who, of course, is the author of Democracy and Delusion, 10 Myths in South African Politics. And whilst we have been talking a little bit about the content of the book, I'm actually more interested in how it came to be. If you would like to hear more about the content of the book, you can go to omni.fm and listen to Sizwe's conversations with my colleagues Eusebius and Koketso Sachani, of course. We're talking about the writing process and what it means to be a writer. Is writing something that you've always done, you've always enjoyed?
It is. But I didn't. It takes a great deal of confidence to actually believe you can be a published author.
Yeah.
And only when I went to Oxford and started having my writing being appreciated there did I realize that I actually could say something, or at least get the confidence to say something. I think we live in quite an ageist society, and particularly when people speak about politics, there's this assumption in South Africa that you have to be 65
Absolutely.
Before you can be taken seriously.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. And so it really took affirmation at Oxford to get me to realize that there's no need to wait.
Yeah.
Now is actually the right time, and you are good enough to write. And then once you get that confidence, I think it goes from there. But first you have to find it in yourself to believe that you have something to say and to have the confidence to get it across.
Yeah, yeah. When you were younger and were sort of being introduced to different types of literature, what stuck out for what stood out for you? I mean, in terms of writing, which writers did you enjoy? Not necessarily which books, if that makes sense.
Well, you know, actually, I wouldn't put it down to any particular writers, although there are writers that I did enjoy when I was younger. It was just the sheer number of books that were around me.
Yeah.
So my mother is an absolutely voracious reader. Mm. I've never met anyone like her, and there were just always books around. And as a kid, I didn't necessarily read that many of them, or any of them actually. But as I became older and older, I wasn't afraid of books. They were literally part of the furniture, and so I had a very comfortable relationship with books from a very early age because of how important reading was to my mother. And you know, growing up, I read like children's books and all the main ones, you know, Harry Potter and that kind of thing. I was a big soccer fan, so I actually remember finishing a book written by Mark Fish, and it was purportedly written by Mark Fish and Lucas Radebe when I was about 10.
Right.
I don't think it was exactly a work of pristine literature, but
yeah,
books were just always around, and so there wasn't a great sense of intimidation. And the older I got, and the more academically interested and literary, and as my literary interest grew, I suddenly realized why I had this appreciation for books that were always around in my childhood.
How much has music influenced your writing?
It's influenced it tremendously because, you know, I really went on quite a voyage with this project, which comes along with an album.
Yeah, yeah.
And it suddenly started to all look like this, the same one and the same thing, you know, because I was also composing a lot of music. And so editing, for example, is really important, even musically.
Mm.
You know, just the process of what I said earlier about not being afraid to put an idea down and allowing it not to be perfect in its initial form, and then coming back to it over and over again works musically. It works writing prose. It works writing verse.
Yeah.
It works composing music, actually. And just sitting until you can really see the idea come to fruition after several edits is a process that I've actually taken from writing and put into music, and taken from music and put into writing as well.
Interesting, interesting. What comes easier for you, writing lyrics or writing prose?
Writing lyrics.
Yeah.
Funnily enough,
yeah,
absolutely.
Sure.
I mean, I would almost treat myself after because I actually wrote the book first and then I wrote the album. And,
yeah.
But the album was like a reward for writing the book.
Okay.
You know, so I would.
So the book was like eating the vegetables first on a plate,
exactly,
and then the album was like the chicken.
Yeah. exactly. Because the book, you know, it had references, and
it was
written, and there was a great deal of research, and just putting it all together was this big jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
And then the artistic freedom of the verses, and just saying whatever comes to your mind. It was just,
that must have been like
so liberating.
Having a bath in Cape Town. I mean, that must have been incredible.
Well, yeah, gee, as luxuries go, it was up there.
Yeah, I'm sure. How private were you with your writing process? I mean, were you sort of writing a chapter and then showing it to your wife, or then showing it to mom or dad, or were you like me and didn't let anyone see a single word until it was in print and it was too late for anyone to change it?
Wow, even in print, that's quite something.
Yeah, no, it was full on.
Oh my goodness, that's hectic. I was probably a level down from you on that score. So I did actually do a lot of the writing, and then once I had a first draft, then I let two or three people see it.
Wow.
And yeah, and then you know they gave me their feedback and.
How were you with the feedback? Because when you do this thing of writing a book, it's a very I think no matter whatever genre you're writing, it's still a very personal thing because you are plowing so much of your time and energy. Let's not even talk about the energy that goes into to writing a book. To have it then offer it to somebody. Was an incredibly personal sort of thing to do, which is why I chose to not really do it. How did you deal with the feedback, good or bad? I'm sure there wasn't much bad. But critical,
you know,
critical.
No, absolutely. And you feel very vulnerable.
Yes.
You feel as though it would be tremendously embarrassing if someone turned around and said, you kind of just wasted 3 years. But I actually, as I said, I was doing a lot of researching about writers and how they write. And again, Teju Cole said something really interesting, which I think came at a good time for me, which was, he said, because he also teaches writing, and he told the story of how he already knows the good writers in his class. And it's not the writers who have the deepest vocabulary or, you know, who even write the boldest things or have the widest experiences.
Yeah.
It's the ones who react the best to feedback. And you necessarily have blind spots as a person and as a writer, you know.
Yeah, that is a really good point.
Yeah, and just having the humility to realize that you have blind spots, even with this thing that you, you know, labored over for so long was really important, because I listened to him saying this as I'd finished. And I think had I not listened to that, I wouldn't have listened to anyone's feedback. You know, I'd have just said, I don't want to hear anything, like, I've spent 3 years on this. But actually, when you realize that feedback, if it comes from the right place, is actually making you better.
Absolutely.
That is what allowed me to let three people see it.
Yeah, yeah. That's a lot. I think it was Jennifer Egan who talked about saying something along the lines of, you can only be a writer if you're willing to write badly, or along those lines, which goes completely against what's inherently in me, which is first of all my crippling perfectionism, which is massively debilitating, and also the idea that I would put anything down on paper that isn't word perfect. And it's that thing of editing again that you're talking about. And I really struggled with that, because there were moments with writing where I would write a chapter and I'd think, God, you know, come on, Pulitzer Prize. And then then the next day I'd write something and I'd think, this is humiliating, and I really need to give up the day job, and this is really bad. You know, and I would have those highs and lows of writing, because I think, and I don't know whether this is because this was my first book or whether maybe this is just me, is that I'm not a consistent writer. And I wonder if anyone is a consistent writer. Do you know what I mean? I wonder if Paul Beattie is consistently excellent.
That's really interesting. Just on that, isn't it also fascinating how some of the things you wrote, which you really were quite proud of, people are kind of like, oh, that's nice. And some of the things you kind of almost hid.
That's so funny.
People pick up and then say, you know what, this is really the thing that got me in this book. And, and you're even more at sea, because you think, wow, maybe even my eye for what I write isn't always the best. And I guess that's again why the process is only really complete once it's been read.
What does validation look like for you when it comes to writing? Where does your validation come from? Does it come, is it inherent in you, or does it come from the outside? Because if I'm being really honest, quite a lot of mine still comes from external.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree. I think, you know, it's all well and good to say validation comes internally. I think it is important that one feels comfortable with what one's written. So that one feels like this is roughly as good as I could make it, given the constraints that I had.
Yes.
But you also do want people, you know, who've read widely to see your writing and say, wow, that's actually really well put, or I can see the craft in that. And I think that still matters. And I think that is important even artistically, you know, for critical appreciation.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite part of the book?
I do. Chapter 7 I like, which is the ANC liberated South Africa. And there's a section there about, roads must fall and the appropriation of history, and Helen Ziller's comments on colonialism. I really like that part, sort of the end, the second half of chapter 7.
She says frantically. frantically scrolling through.
Funnily enough, I felt quite uneasy about the chapter on elite schools.
Did you?
Yeah.
Tell me why.
I thought, because it was a different register, because there was a lot of personal stories.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if people would think, you know, this isn't necessarily rigorous. This is anecdotal.
Yeah, that's why I loved it.
And I've certainly taken that on board. And I think with future writing, I will do even more of that probably.
Yeah. Talk to us more about future writing. What, I mean, this is the first book. What will come next, do you think? I mean, do you think you would ever, I mean, you're obviously, you know, as our mutual friend Goog says, you are obviously one of our brightest young minds, and that is true.
Thanks.
But do you think you will ever, I mean, would it ever be in your mind to write a work of fiction or a book of poetry or...
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Definitely. And I think also this speaks to, now I speak about race in the book, but I think for people of color, black people, however people prefer to self-identify sometimes.
How do you self-identify, by the way?
I don't know. It's different at different times. It's, in fact, something that I grapple with quite a lot.
Sure.
And continue to grapple with.
Yeah.
Certainly not as white. I mean, I think that's ruled out from the off.
Yeah.
But, you know, I then went through a period where...
Politically black?
Political blackness was important. But then spending time in the UK, one realizes that, you know, there is also a proximity to whiteness being, quote, mixed race. And you have to come to terms with the privilege, but also the... You know, the oppression that seems to happen simultaneously.
Getting
so
goosebumps. Yep.
Yeah. It's always so difficult to really put into words how the world boxes you and how you box yourself as a result.
Yeah.
So we really need a conversation about this at some point.
Yeah. I was just thinking that. We really do.
Yeah.
We will do that another time for sure.
Sure. In fact, there's a great film. Called Mixed Space, which
yes.
I was invited to be a part of. And
were
yeah,
you?
Yeah. I'm one of the people interviewed in the film.
I need to see it. I need
yeah,
to see
so
it. Is that Kellyanne Kutman and Sarah Summers?
No, it's Zara Julius.
Zara Julius, who I also...
Yeah,
yeah okay. Who I'm actually going to be speaking to soon. Zara Julius, yes.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, well, that's... It's literally about this question. And so,
how fascinating. I didn't know you knew Zara. Okay, great stuff.
Yes.
The world is small.
Indeed.
We're getting everywhere. We're getting everywhere.
Yeah, we are.
We're infiltrating. listen, I'm fast-looking at the time, and I know I said to you 20 minutes of your time, and I see that we've cruised well past that. We will have that conversation, and I would love to do that. I'd love to have you in studio for that. That would be fantastic. Listen, just back on the writing, and just to sum up. For you, and we've talked a little bit about, you know, possible future projects. What's the idea once the doctorate's over, by the way? What's the plan?
Well, I used to plan very meticulously for the future, and then, you know, I just realized that it's a fool's errand, really.
Yeah.
So I just want to really make this book and album as good as they can be, push them as hard as I can, and I think that'll open several doors, hopefully, for the future. I'm pursuing more of a counter-attacking life strategy these days.
Awesome.
but there will certainly be political work, there will certainly be writing, and there will certainly be music.
Oh, I'm excited for that. I'm really excited for that. Tell me, with the book and the album, I mean, the book, you know, when I was, we ended up next to each other doing a bit of signing at Open Book the other day.
Yeah.
And I mean, the people that were buying your book, I mean, how do I say this? The people that were buying your book were from all walks of, well, no, not all walks of life. There were a lot of older white people buying your book.
I know. It's quite fascinating, actually.
It is fascinating.
Yeah,
and on that, I'm fairly sure they're not also buying the accompanying album. But I could be wrong. Are they?
Well, it's funny because there are a lot of older people buying the album as well.
And I
bump into people, and this was really one of my hopes, which is I'm slowly starting to see is that really young people or people you wouldn't expect to read are engaging with the book.
Yeah.
But really old people or people you wouldn't expect to engage with hip-hop and rap are engaging with the album.
Cracking.
And
so...
It is kind of attracting an unexpected audience, both from race, age, class. It's quite cross-cutting, so I'm really happy about that.
I am so thrilled for you. I really am. This book is a masterpiece, if I may say so, and I would really
encourage.
No, I mean really, it's my book of the year, and I would encourage everyone to go and buy it. And I don't say that lightly. It's the kind of book that I'm reading and rereading, and I've only had it for a week. I'm invested in this book.
Great satisfaction.
No, for sure. And you really are one of our brightest young minds. In terms of political would you follow in Dad's footsteps?
Well, politics has always been important to me. The difficulty I find is fitting into, you know, categories and boxes. So I do, you know, I do like the direction that the EFF has gone in. I think it's, all things considered, been a good thing for putting race back on the agenda, putting economic redistribution back on the agenda.
Mm.
But I think there are also still some details to be filled out. There's a lot to be done on that side. So I want to do something in the South African political space, but I also know that if I just follow directly in my father's footsteps, for example, I'm going to have to do a lot of explaining, you know, over and over again, which can become quite frustrating. Yeah, so I haven't quite figured it out yet, but I will certainly always work in that direction. I think that the beautiful thing about the generation that I'm in is that we can change and bust the stereotypes and do new things in different ways. You know, before you couldn't write a book and a rap album at the same time. And maybe there is something different that transcends what is traditional about politics that I might be able to find as I keep exploring.
I think you are finding it. I think that's great, and I think you will be a champion in that regard. I am so thrilled that you agreed to chat to us this morning. Thank you so much. The book is called Democracy and Delusion, 10 Myths in South African Politics. The author is somebody that I'm now choosing to call my friend, Cesar Mpofu-Wall. Cesar, it's been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much. All the best with it. And, let's get that chat sorted soon on identity.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think we have a lot to speak about, so I look forward to that chat. And thank you so much for this chat and for supporting this project.
You're welcome. Thanks, Cesar.